The archive room was cold, a sterile windowless space humming with the low vibration of refrigeration units. The air smelled sharply of ozone and old paper, a scent that lodged itself behind the teeth and refused to leave. Wren stood before the heavy oak shelving, her fingers brushing the spines of ledgers that spanned 3 decades of business records. She had come to Birmingham on Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock, carrying nothing but a ledger bound in red leather, 3 sovereigns, and a trunk of clothes left in storage. It had been 10 years since she had last visited this city, and the memory of her father's pragmatic coldness felt closer now than it had in Oakhaven. The hum started halfway down, low, constant, the vibration of machinery older than she was. Refrigeration units, she supposed. The archives needed cold preservation for the paper records, or perhaps for something else entirely. She told herself she was here for the paper. That was the plan. Paper was safe. Paper could be read and understood and filed away in a mental drawer marked facts. The door at the bottom was steel, painted a pale institutional green that had yellowed with age. A brass plate held the words, Birmingham Medical School Archives and Storage. Wren pushed it open and stepped into a corridor that stretched in either direction, gas jets humming overhead, their light flat and ungenerous. The floor was linoleum, cracked in places, the pattern of it worn smooth by decades of footsteps. She walked forward. The first room was an antechamber, sparsely furnished with a wooden desk and a metal chair. A woman sat behind the desk, her hair pinned severely back, her glasses perched on the end of her nose. She looked up as Wren entered, her expression neutral, the kind of professional neutrality that suggested she had seen every type of visitor this building had to offer and found none of them interesting. I'm looking for Dr. Thorne, Wren said. Her voice sounded thin in the sterile air, smaller than she intended. The woman consulted a ledger on her desk. Room 3, at the end of the hall. He's expecting you. She didn't ask how Wren knew Dr. Thorne or why a young woman in a charcoal wool coat had arrived unannounced at 9 in the morning. Some questions were simply not asked in buildings like this. Wren thanked her and walked down the corridor. Room 3 was at the end, the door ajar. Inside, the room was larger than she expected, perhaps 40 feet across, lined with metal shelving units that rose to the ceiling, their surfaces painted the same institutional green as the door. The shelves held boxes. Thousands of them. Cardboard, labeled, stacked in neat rows that disappeared into the shadows above. The air was colder here, the cold seeping through her coat and settling into her bones. Dr. Aris Thorne stood near the center of the room, his back to her, examining a folder. He was taller than she had imagined from Silas's letter, or perhaps Silas had deliberately undersold him. His shoulders were broad beneath a tweed jacket, his posture rigid, the posture of a man who had spent too many years standing in rooms exactly like this one. He turned when Wren cleared her throat, and his face was exactly what she had expected. Clean-shaven, balding, eyes the color of weak tea. Wren, he said. His voice was calm, measured, the voice of a man who had learned long ago that urgency was a sign of amateurism. You've come a long way. The train was on time, Wren said. It wasn't quite true, but she didn't elaborate. Dr. Thorne nodded, as if this were sufficient. He gestured toward the shelves. I trust you understand why I agreed to show you what you asked for, but only under certain conditions. What you see here is not public record. It is medical research history, and it is sensitive. Wren met his gaze. I understand. He studied her for a moment, his expression unreadable. Then he reached into his jacket pocket and produced a ring of keys. Then let us begin. He led her deeper into the archive, past row after row of metal shelving, past boxes labeled with dates and categories that meant nothing to her anatomy, 1882-1885. Surgical cases, 1890-1893. Unclaimed bodies, 1895-1901. The last category made her pause. Unclaimed. As if the people inside had never been claimed by anyone. As if they had simply ceased to matter. Dr. Thorne stopped at a section near the back of the room. The shelves here were different, narrower, older, their paint peeling. The boxes were smaller, too, and their labels were handwritten in a cramped, precise script that Wren recognized immediately. Her father's handwriting. She felt the air leave her lungs. Elias Halloway, Dr. Thorne said, reading the label aloud. 52 entries spanning 20 years. Your father was remarkably consistent. Ren couldn't speak. She reached out and touched the nearest box. The cardboard was brittle, flaking at the edges, and she pulled her hand back quickly, afraid it would disintegrate beneath her fingers. Inside, she knew, was whatever had been left behind when the bodies arrived, clothing, personal effects, whatever scraps of identity remained after the medical school had taken what it needed. Or perhaps the boxes contained the remains themselves. She didn't want to think about it. She didn't want to know. But she needed to. "May I?" Dr. Thorne asked. He didn't wait for permission. He lifted the lid of the top box and withdrew a folder, thick with pages, and set it on a metal table that stood between two rows of shelving. Ren approached slowly, her boots clicking against the linoleum, each sound amplified by the silence of the room. The folder opened with a crackle. Inside were pages of typed text, arranged in columns and rows, each entry accompanied by a photograph, a small, black and white image, grainy and indistinct, showing a face that might have been male or female, young or old, alive or dead. Ren couldn't tell. The photographs were too small, too degraded by time. She leaned closer, squinting, and read the text beside each image. Subject 147. Male, approximately 55 years. Cause of receipt, unclaimed pauper, workhouse infirmary, St. Jude's, date received, 14 March 1893. Catalog number, BMS 1893-147. Disposition, anatomical specimen, preserved. Notes, decent condition. Useful for teaching purposes. She moved to the next entry. Subject 148. Female, approximately 32 years. Cause of receipt, died in childbirth, City Hospital. Date received, 17 March 1893. Catalog number, BMS 1893-148. Disposition, anatomical specimen, preserved. Notes, poor condition. Limited utility. Subject 149. Subject 150. Subject 151. Each one a number. Each one a cataloged object. Each one a person reduced to a line of text and a photograph no larger than a postage stamp. Ren read them in silence, her finger tracing the lines as if the act of touching the page might somehow restore the humanity that the words had erased. By subject 203, she understood the pattern. Every entry followed the same format: a number, a brief description of the deceased, the source of the body, the date of receipt, the catalog number, and a clinical assessment of the body's condition. There was no name. There never would be a name. The system was designed to ensure that names were never recorded, never preserved, never remembered. "Your father supplied 47 subjects over the course of 2 decades, Dr. Thorne said. He had moved to stand beside her, his hands clasped behind his back, his tone the same calm, detached register he had maintained since she arrived. Not all of them were from Oakhaven. The network extended across the Midlands, Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, but your father's contribution was significant, consistent, reliable. The medical school valued him highly. 47. The number hung in the air between them, heavy and immovable. 47 people. 47 catalog numbers. 47 subjects who had been received, cataloged, preserved, and used for teaching purposes, their identities stripped away before they even reached these shelves. Ren thought of Arthur Gable. She thought of the urn on Maeve Collins's mantelpiece, too light to be real. She thought of the ledger entry October 14th. Male, 61, cardiac failure. Service, standard cremation. Fee, £18. She had read those words in the dark of the records room, her finger tracing the faded ink, and she had felt something break inside her. But this was different. This was the other side of the transaction. This was where the bodies ended up, after the funeral home had done its part, after the ashes had been mixed with mill ash and handed to a grieving widow who would never know the difference. "Where are they now?" Ren asked. Her voice was steady, which surprised her. "The remains, are they still here?" Dr. Thorne hesitated. It was the first hesitation she had seen from him, and it gave her a strange sense of satisfaction. Most of them were disposed of according to protocol after their utility had been exhausted. Some were reburied in consecrated ground. Others were cremated. The records for disposition are separate from the intake records. He paused. But some specimens survived longer than others. Anatomy is a patient discipline. Ren looked at the shelves around her, at the thousands of boxes rising to the ceiling, at the endless rows of cataloged subjects stretching into the shadows. She thought of her father, sitting at his desk in the funeral home, writing ledger entries in his neat, precise hand. October 14th. Male, 61, cardiac failure. Service, standard cremation. Fee, £18. He had never once written a name. He had never once considered that the man who died on October 14th might have had a name, a family, a life that extended beyond the 6 feet of earth his widow would have dug for him. "He never told me," Wren said. "It wasn't a question. It was an observation, stated flatly without accusation or grief, just a fact like the others." Dr. Thorne's expression didn't change. He set the folder down, aligning its edges with the table. "You've seen the intake records. The disposition records are kept separately there in the East Wing, locked cabinet. If you want to trace where the bodies went after the medical school was done with them, that's where you'd look. But I should warn you, the disposition records are incomplete for the earlier years. There are gaps." Dr. Thorne's face remained impassive. He lowered the folder to the desk, taking care to square its corners against the wood grain. "You have reviewed the intake ledgers. The disposition logs are maintained apart, stored in the East Wing, within a locked cabinet. To follow the trail of the remains once the medical school concluded its work, that is your destination. Yet I must caution you, those records are fragmentary for the earlier decade. Significant gaps exist. Subject 312. Male, 48, industrial accident at the Bolton Textile Mill. Inbound, 3 September 1898. Catalog number, BMS 1898-312. Disposition, anatomical specimen preserved. Notes, right arm intact, valuable for study of trauma. Industrial accident, textile mill. Bolton, 48 years old. A man who had worked with his hands, who had earned his living in a factory, who had died in a machine and ended up here, cataloged and preserved and studied by students who would never know his name. His right arm had been intact. Someone had noted that. Someone had found it valuable. Wren closed the folder. The crackle of the pages sounded loud in the silence. "I need to see more," she said. Dr. Thorne regarded her for a long moment. Then he nodded and reached for the next folder on the table. "There are 20 years of records, Miss Halloway. If you wish to review them all, it will take the better part of the day." "I have all day," Wren said, and she did. She had come to Birmingham with nothing but a trunk of clothes and 3 sovereigns and a determination she couldn't quite name. She had nowhere else to be. The funeral home could wait. Selah's could wait. The widows of Oakhaven could wait, though the thought of them, sitting in their parlors with urns on their mantelpieces, made something tighten in her chest. Dr. Thorne opened the next folder. The next, and the next. Wren read them all. She read until her eyes burned and her neck ached, and the fluorescent light buzzed in her ears like a trapped insect. She read until the numbers blurred together: subject 412, subject 413, subject 414, and she couldn't tell where one entry ended and the next began. She read until the words lost their meaning and became only sounds, syllables arranged in patterns that her brain processed without comprehension. But she kept reading, because stopping meant acknowledging that she had seen enough, and she hadn't, not nearly enough. At lunchtime, Dr. Thorne produced a thermos of tea and 2 paper cups from a drawer in the metal table. He set them down without comment, and Wren took one and drank it standing, her eyes still on the page. The tea was bitter and lukewarm, and exactly what she needed. By afternoon, she had read through 14 years of records, 14 years of catalog numbers, 14 years of men and women and children who had died and been received and cataloged and preserved, their identities erased by the simple efficiency of a numbering system. She had seen entries for paupers and factory workers and hospital patients and women who had died in childbirth. She had seen entries for people who had been claimed by no one and claimed by everyone, depending on which side of the transaction you were on. On her father's side, they were fees, £18, £12, £22, numbers that balanced the ledger, that kept the funeral home solvent, that allowed her to polish brass and arrange flowers and stand in parlors and tell widows that their husbands had been properly laid to rest. On this side, they were subjects, catalog numbers, anatomical specimens, items of utility. The 2 sets of numbers were the same. They were just written in different hands. Dr. Thorne closed the last folder for the day and straightened his jacket. "That will have to suffice for today. We can continue tomorrow morning. Ren nodded. She couldn't speak. Her throat was tight, her eyes dry, her mind full of numbers, catalog numbers, ledger entries, fees, sums, totals, all of them swirling together in a pattern she couldn't untangle. She picked up her purse from the floor where she had set it, slung it over her shoulder, and followed Dr. Thorne back up the stairs. The station was exactly as she remembered it from 10 years ago, the corrugated iron roof, the wooden benches, the smell of coal smoke and damp wool. She sat on one of the benches and waited for the train, her trunk at her feet, her mind still in the basement, still among the shelves and the boxes and the endless rows of catalog numbers. When the train arrived, she boarded it and found a seat by the window and watched the city recede, brick buildings and gas lamps and the dark shapes of factories, all of them receding into the gray distance, all of them disappearing behind her as surely as the catalog numbers had disappeared from her mind, replaced by something worse. Certainty. She knew what her father had done. She knew what the funeral home had done. She knew what the urns on mantelpieces across Oak Haven contained not ashes, but ash, mixed with mill residue and weighed out with the same precision that her father had used to balance his ledger. The train pulled out of Birmingham station and gained speed, the wheels clicking against the tracks, the rhythm steady and mechanical and indifferent. Ren Halloway sat in the compartment and stared at her reflection in the window, pale, indistinct, a ghost superimposed over the passing landscape, and she felt something settle into her chest like a stone dropped into deep water. She would go home, she would sit at her father's desk, she would open the ledger, and she would begin to understand what came next.